This morning we're going to talk about the Bible, and it's something I'm very passionate about, so today I will get excited about what I'm talking about, so I hope that's okay. I hope you might get a bit excited as well. Has anyone here ever read through the whole of the Bible from start to finish? A few of you are. Okay. If you put about 20 minutes a day for the next 12 months into reading through the Bible, you'll complete it within a year. You can do the Soul Survivor reading plan if you want, and they have little videos and stuff that accompany each passage. But can I challenge some of you, well, all of you in fact, but some of you will respond to this challenge. Make it your aim in this next year, maybe starting as the day you get back from Soul Survivor, to read through the whole Bible in 1 year. Give it 20 minutes a day. My parents have read through the whole Bible every year for the last 26 years. Some of you in this room, maybe one or two of you, might take up a challenge to do that every year for the rest of your life. Why not? Because the Bible is the thing that is the book that God has given to us, that teaches us about Jesus and that connects us with the great stories of the faith, which will transform our lives. And so if you're someone who takes Jesus seriously, if you're someone who wants to, maybe you're aspiring to be a leader in the church or you're really passionate about God, then consider that. Maybe for the rest of your life, every year, you could read through the whole Bible and you will get to know the stories. And so what I want to do with you this morning is to just give you a little overview. I'm going to talk about every single book of the 39 in the Old Testament. And then this afternoon in Cafe Uno, which is just across there, we're going to go through the New Testament. And I hope that what you will get is something, just a flavor of what the Bible story is all about and how incredibly exciting it is. You can split the Old Testament up, and this is just one way to do it. But it's just to give you a big picture of it, really. You can split the Old Testament up into 17 books, then 5 in the middle, and then 17 at the other side. So the first 17 what you could broadly call history books. So they tell the story of the people of Israel. So 17 history. And then in the middle, from Job to Song of Songs, you've got 5 wisdom books. Okay, these 5 in the middle, cleverly color-coded by me, are what you call wisdom books. And then from Isaiah all the way to Malachi, you've got what we call the prophets. Okay, so 17 history, 17 prophets, and in the middle, 5 wisdom. Okay, it's just a neat little way of trying to remember the structure of the Old Testament. Now, these two 17s, you can also split up into 5 and 12. So these 5 here, Genesis to Deuteronomy, you would broadly call the call different things, but the 5 books of Moses. So the 5 books that are generally kind of attributed to Moses. Or the Pentateuch, they're also called. And then the rest of them, kind of the other historical books. And then with the prophets, you've got the 5 major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And Jeremiah wrote Lamentations. So there's 5 books by the major prophets. And then the 12 minor prophets. Now, they're called the major prophets, not because they're more important, just because generally their books are a bit longer than the minor prophets. So 17, 5, 17, and each of the 17s are split up into 5 and 12. Some of you will like those numbers because you're geeks, like me. And we're going to go through every single book, and I'm going to talk about a little bit about every book in the next 40 minutes. Do you think I'll be able to do it? Some of you do and some of you don't. I'm going to spend about 10 minutes in Genesis. And at the end of that 10 minutes, you're going to be worried and you'll think he's never going to do it. But then I will. Okay. Don't fill those of you taking notes, you're the keynotes. Feel free to not take notes from the whole thing. You don't have to, you know, You don't have to write something about every book, but I'm going to mention every single book. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the Bible begins with Genesis. And the Bible begins with what I call an explosion of goodness. An explosion of goodness. Because, you know, scientists call it the Big Bang. But the world comes into being. The earth was formless and void. And the Spirit of God was moving over the waters. And then suddenly God speaks into this emptiness, into this kind of chaos, into this wilderness almost. And God speaks goodness. I don't know about you. Who's just finished studying in some way? You've just got, you finished GCSEs or A-levels. Yeah. So how many of you are really glad to have finished? How many of you actually, weirdly, are looking forward to writing some more essays when you continue your studies because you like essays? Some of you. You're a geek like me. I love writing essays, right? I finished a master's degree a few years ago. And within about 6 months, I was missing writing essays. That's how sad I am. And I remember sometimes I love writing sentences and then reading them back. And occasionally I would write a sentence. I'd read it back to myself and I'd think, that's pretty good, actually. You know, I'm quite jealous of the examiner who's going to read this, And that's what God's a little bit like in Genesis 1. God speaks and he creates something, the land and the plants and the stars in the sky. And then he stops and he goes, that is good. That is good. And so there's this goodness before sin comes into the world, before of the stories in Genesis 3 to 11. You get this goodness. And so the world is created with goodness and with the words of God. And then, before we get to Genesis 3, something that is not good. Can anyone tell me what is not good in Genesis 2? It's good. And we get to the creation of human beings, and then God says it's very good. But what isn't good in chapter 2? Anyone tell me? Yes. No, not the apple. The apple's in chapter 3. Yes. Sin? No, sin is in chapter 3. Anyone else? Yes. The man, it's not good for the man to be alone. Okay? So, in Genesis, you've got this incredible scene in the Garden of Eden where the man who's been created has this incredible relationship with God where there's no sin separating them. But even within that, God says, it's not good for them to be alone. It's not good for him to be alone. But he's with God, so how can he be alone? But actually, there's something right in the start of the Bible that teaches us that we're created to need each other. Okay? So before we start doing things that are wrong in Genesis 3 to 11, it's not good for us to be alone. And that's really important to know. When we sing songs like, Jesus is all I need, it's not actually true. Because God has made us to need each other as well. That's why we have church. That's why we have family. That's why we have marriage. That's why we have close friends, because we need each other. And that's okay. We need each other. So God has created us. It's not good for us to be alone. And then we get to chapter 3, which is this famous story about the fall, Adam and Eve in the garden and they eat the fruit and all of that stuff. But it's not just chapter 3 and that little story. It's chapter 3 to 11. So the whole section of Genesis, which teaches us, what does it look like when human beings rebel against God? And the answer is, it's pretty nasty. Not only Adam and Eve's rebellion, but also you get the first murder, Cain and Abel. You get the flood story with Noah, when God's heart is grieved that he even created human beings because they're that sinful. You get the vengeance of Lamech. You get chapter 11, the Tower of Babel and the arrogance of humans. And so this whole section teaches us, what does it look like when human beings rebel against God? And the answer is, it's pretty terrible. The worst things that you can imagine that humans do happen in Genesis 3 to 11. And so God chooses a person, in fact, two people. What are their names in Genesis chapter 12? Who can tell me that? Anyone? Come on. Genesis 12, God calls, yes, Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham and Sarah, well, Abram at the time. And God, and the God who called the worlds into being makes a second call. The God who called the worlds into being makes a second call. And the God who said, let there be light, says, let there be a people who will be a light to the world. Okay, and so Abraham and Sarah are called and their descendants to be a light to the world and a blessing to all the families of the earth. Because God always chooses a people, not just a person. Okay, and that's and so he chooses this people and their descendants, and they're going to show the world, and this is the idea, what it is to follow God and to have a relationship with God. And Paul, the Apostle Paul, teaches us in Galatians 3 that Abraham was given the gospel in advance. Okay, Abraham was given the gospel, the good news, in advance. So if you want to know about the gospel and about Jesus, start in with the story of Abraham, because he gets a sneak preview of it. He gets to watch like a trailer, if you like, of what's to come. And for me, the gospel in advance for Abraham was three things. One was that Abraham was called to have faith with God. So it kind of parallels the great Jesus's great commands and great commission. So he's called to have faith in God, like love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And then to be a blessing to all the families of the earth, which parallels the Great Commission, which is go into all the world and make disciples and teaching them all, you know, to obey everything I've commanded to you and baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. And so you've got this kind of the seeds of the gospel in the Abraham story. Also, if you look in Genesis chapter 22, which is the first mention of worship in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 5, Abraham and Isaac, his son, so he's had this promise that he will have a son, even though he was 75, and he has to wait for the promise till he's 99, and then Sarah gets pregnant, and then they have Isaac. And then one day God turns up and he says, I want you to sacrifice Isaac on the mountain. Abraham obeys God. In that culture, it would have been it was expected that the gods would demand the things that are most important to you. So sometimes this sounds like a really brutal story that God would do that. But the point of this story is that God, the God of Abraham, is not the kind of God that demands that of us, because ultimately, He says that God will provide the lamb. But they walk up this hill, and think about the parallels between this and the Jesus story. The Father and the Son walk up this hill together, and they go to worship. And he says, me and the boy are going to go up this hill to worship, and we will come down. We will come down. And so Abraham's got this kind of faith in God, that even if he has to go through with this horrific act, that somehow that the two of them will still return. There's like a, almost like a hope of the resurrection. And we and the son carries the wood for the sacrifice on his back. Think about Jesus going up the hill of Calvary with the wood for him, for his sacrifice on his back, and the son carries it up. And Isaac says to Abraham, "Where's the lamb for the sacrifice, Dad?" and Abraham says, "The Lord Himself will provide the lamb. The Lord Himself will provide the lamb." And by Jewish tradition, on the Mount of Moriah is where the temple was built ultimately. And from that temple mount, you can see Calvary. And just in my mind, I can, you know, Abraham getting the gospel in advance. And as he says, the Lord Himself will provide the lamb. I just imagine Abraham looking at Calvary from this hill and seeing into the future almost and prophetically saying that the Lord Himself will provide the lamb. And so you get Abraham and Isaac, and then you get Jacob. Does anyone know what Jacob changed his name to? Israel. Well done. And Israel has 12 sons. Okay, and the 12 sons of Israel, one of them has a coat of many colors. What was his name? Shout it out, Joseph. There, you're getting warmed up now. That's good. And because of the Joseph story, they end up in a country called Egypt, and that takes us to the end of Genesis. You'll be delighted to know. And so, at the end of Genesis, we get to the Exodus story, because what happens is that the 12 sons of Israel have families, and the 12 families of Israel reproduce quite rapidly. And a little bit like my sister, who's got 10 children at the moment, she might have had more while I've been away, I don't know, but But they have a similar approach to family planning to my sister, which is none whatsoever. And they have many, many children and become the 12 tribes of Israel. And as such, in this foreign country, they become like a bit of a threat to the government. And so they put them in slavery. And so at the start of Exodus, you get this story of the people of God crying out to God again and saying, would you free us from slavery? And in my opinion, Exodus is the most important story in the whole of the Old Testament. Okay, so if you want to know the roots of loads of our faith, get to know the Exodus story. Not just Genesis, but read Exodus and study it and get to know it. Because it's so important to the prophets. It's so important. And even Jesus mentions it in Luke 9, verse 31. Jesus is on this the Mount of Transfiguration and he's chatting with... And somehow Moses and Elijah turn up. I've no idea how this happens. But Jesus starts glowing all white. And then Moses and Elijah are there. And Jesus is talking to Moses, who led the Exodus, led the people out of freedom. And Luke says in Luke 9:31 that Jesus was talking to Moses and Elijah about his Exodus, the Exodus that Jesus was going to accomplish. It might say in your Bible the word departure, but the word is Exodus. And so, and Jesus basically describes what he's going to do on the cross using the word Exodus. Because it's not just for, what Jesus is doing is not just for one group of people at one point in history, but it's going to bring freedom to everyone who would want to receive it at all points in history and all across the world. Okay, so the Exodus story is massively important. And so they emerge as a nation, not just a group of tribes. They receive the covenant from God. So they get to the foot of the mountain where Moses goes up and gets the Ten Commandments. And they receive that covenant from God. God reveals his name to them. So he says, I'm not just going to be the most high God, but I'm going to reveal my name, Yahweh, which means I am who I am. And that showed like... a kind of certain intimacy with the people. I don't know if you ever, when you're at school, when you find out the first name of one of your teachers. I remember when I was a kid, and I would have like Mrs. Oakes, but I would find out that her name was Judy, and it would be like, she's called Judy, and I feel like I know her a little bit more, and it's almost like a closeness that happens, and that's what happens, you know, when God shares His name with the people. He's saying, I'm going to bring you in here. You're part of the family here. There's an intimacy that happens between God and His people. So the Exodus is hugely important. And then in Leviticus, those of you that have read through the whole Bible or try to, usually people fail in Leviticus because you read it and you think, why am I reading about how to treat mildew and what to do when I've had a nocturnal emission? Talk to your youth leader about what that means. But actually, Leviticus is about worship. It's about worship because it's... The word Levi, the name Levi means to join together. And so the Levites were like the worship leaders of the Hebrew people. And so their job was to join the people and God together, to help the people to encounter God. And so the high point for me of Leviticus is chapter 16. And the priest goes into the temple, into the most holy place. And the high priest was only allowed to go into the holiest place of the temple or the tabernacle only once a year to meet with God and ask for forgiveness. And it was so holy, they were so scared about it, that they would put a rope round his ankle in case he died so they could pull him out. And that's the kind of fear that was associated with it. And the high priest would go in and he would surround himself with clouds of incense. And as he did that, the cloud of God would descend and you would get this incredible coming together of the cloud of God and the clouds of incense, and heaven would touch earth and he would sprinkle blood on the mercy seat and he would ask God for forgiveness for the nation. And this only happened once a year. And Jesus stood before the high priest of his day, who was called Caiaphas. And Caiaphas said to Jesus, are you the Messiah, the Son of God? And Jesus said this, it is as you say, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming in the clouds of heaven. So Jesus is saying to Caiaphas, I'm the one who's coming in the clouds of heaven. I'm heaven touching earth. I'm the one who is coming. And so it's no wonder Caiaphas ripped his robes and said that he was a blasphemer, because that's what Jesus was claiming. And so After Leviticus and after they get the law, you get this period of 40 years where they wander around the desert. That's the book of Numbers. Okay, in Numbers, they wander around the desert for 40 years because they're not allowed, that generation is not allowed into the promised land because of sin. And so they wander around this desert for 40 years, and they're the stories of the book of Numbers. In Numbers 24, verse 17, you get the story of Balaam. Balaam's the guy who had a talking donkey. That's another story that we don't have time to go into. But he was a prophet, but he wasn't like a kind of Christian prophet. He was what you might call a seer or almost like a kind of occult prophet. But he tried to prophesy against Israel, but then God kept stopping him and making him prophesy for Israel. And he saw this vision of a star coming out of Israel and kind of prophesying a great leader that would be to come. The Israelites believed that that was a prophecy about King David, but also beyond King David, they believed it was a prophecy of the Messiah. So he saw a star, Balaam, that pointed to the Messiah ultimately. If you think about the way that Luke describes, the gospel writers describe the Magi, were prophets, seers, like Balaam was. So they saw a star that pointed them to the Messiah. But, you know, some people argue that the Magi were kind of like in the line of Balaam, the same kind of people as Balaam was. And so both of them saw a star that pointed ultimately to the Messiah that led them to Jesus. And then finally you get Deuteronomy, and you get they get to the edge of the promised land, and Moses is not allowed to go in. So he preaches three great sermons, and the three great sermons of Moses are recorded in Deuteronomy. So these sermons are much longer than the talk I'm giving you today. And Jesus quotes, you know, in that scene in the Gospels where Jesus is in the wilderness and the devil comes and tempts him. Well, Jesus quotes Deuteronomy, the same kind of two or three chapters of Deuteronomy. He quotes that bit three times in resisting the devil. It's really interesting. So it's almost like Jesus was meditating on that part of the Bible at that time when the devil comes and he's able to resist him. Also in Deuteronomy 21:23, it says, anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. Anyone who's hung on a tree is under God's curse. And in Galatians 3:13, it says, it kind of quotes that, and it says, Jesus redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. So there's all sorts of things that you find in the Old Testament that if you read, the more you read it through and through and through, the more parallels you'll see and the more things that will be fulfilled in the new. And then the people go into the promised land. Joshua leads them. Moses dies. Joshua leads them into the promised land. So we get the book of Joshua. And then when Joshua dies, you get this kind of weird in-between section, which is after the famous Moses-Joshua period and before the kings come along. And you get this period called the period of the judges. And there's 12 judges. And it's basically this kind of what you call a revival book. I really like the book of Judges, apart from the grotesque violence in it. But some of the stories are amazing. And it's all about the most unlikely people being used by God. So whether it's Deborah, who's this incredible leader who's raised up in a really patriarchal society where people, you know, where men are in charge of everything, and she becomes this incredible leader, there's a guy called Ehud who is part of this tribe of Benjamin, and he's a left-handed person. Anyone left-handed in here? Good. God loves you just a tiny bit more than the rest. And Ehud's left-handed, and he ends up, have you read this one? He kills the fat king, and the king's so fat that the sword goes right inside his belly, and his flesh comes over the hilt of the sword. It's disgusting. It should be on Horrible Histories or something like that. But there's all sorts of people. There's Jephthah, who's the son of a prostitute, and Samson, who's this kind of guy who has a problem with alcohol, but the whole point of his calling is that he doesn't drink alcohol. And all these people that God uses that you think, if you think that God can never use you, that God can never work through you, read a bit of Judges and see that God can do that through anyone, and especially you if you feel like you're the unlikely one. Ruth is in the same time period as the Judges. And Ruth is another great story of a foreigner, a refugee who comes to Israel and finds what we call a redeemer who gives her a new start. And she ends up being an ancestor of David and of Jesus. So she, this foreign person who shouldn't fit in, that the Daily Mail wouldn't like, you know, she ends up becoming part of the genealogy of Jesus himself. And again, just similar to the judges, that God will include anyone in his plan, especially the most unlikely people. And then we get to the time of the kings. So the stories of Samuel. Samuel is he's like kind of the 13th judge, really. So he kind of bridges this time and then the time of the kings. And people come to Samuel and they say, can we have a king? Everyone else has got a king. It's like when your kids say to you, can I have a Nintendo Switch or something? Because all my mates have got one. And you say, no, you've got, you know, you've got your toys. You can have my old Star Wars toys from 30 years ago. get on with it. Go out and play football in the garden. But eventually you give in, and my son's just around that corner playing on his Nintendo Switch right now. And it's like that. And the people say, no, we want a king. Everyone else has got a king. And he says, if you have a king, then they'll oppress you. They'll take taxes off you. They'll send your sons to war and they'll all die. And the people are like, yeah, but can we have a king? Because everyone else has got one. And so they have a king, and the first king is called Saul. And Saul messes up, doesn't he? And so Samuel goes to anoint someone else who's called David. And David goes on, despite all his faults, to become this kind of, to lead Israel into their golden age. And so the kingdom of Israel is united together. If you look at this behind me on this big screen, that's a kind of just breakdown of the time periods in the Old Testament. It just gives you some a place to hold it. So you get this time of the kingdom that is united together. And King David leads the people into this golden age. Even though he's got so many faults, God says he's got a heart. He's a man after my own heart. He's a worshiper. He's a warrior. He's repentant when he needs to be repentant. And he becomes eventually seen as like a model for the Messiah in his best attributes. And then David's son, most well-known son is Solomon. And so you get the stories of David in Samuel. And then you get the stories of Solomon. And so Solomon has got this wisdom that he can make these incredible decisions for the nation. And he leads the people into a time of great riches, and where other countries are kind of admiring them and coming to visit them to see what they've done. But for me, I'm not a big fan of Solomon. Now, some of you might, you know, disagree with me here or stone me or something. But Solomon, he builds a temple for God, the God of the people who are freed slaves. And what does he use to build the temple for the God who frees slaves? Slaves, enforced labor. It's not a good idea, Solomon. Also, he has 700 wives. Okay, now that's quite a lot. That's like 699 more than I've got. But I have got one wife and she's amazing. I really don't need another one. Like, I have no desire for another wife. But he has 700, and they're like status symbols. It's like, check out my classic car collection and my 700 wives and 300 concubines. It's that kind of thing. You know, he's probably only met a few of them, but it's about collecting and being, showing how amazing he is. And after Solomon, his sons war against each other, and the kingdom divides into north and south. Some of you will be able to see that screen bit. And in the north, the kingdom's called Israel, sometimes called Ephraim. And the capital of that is Samaria. And then in the south, you've got Judah, and the capital of Judah is Jerusalem. And so you get this whole narrative throughout Kings and then into Chronicles where it's just like, this king was good, this one was bad, this next one was bad, the next one was bad, 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 good, bad, 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 bad. And then, and it kind of goes on like that, and things get worse and worse, until it leads towards this time of exile. And so both Kings and Chronicles, from slightly different points of view, tell the story of all the kings and the disasters that came upon Israel. But just winding back slightly, during the time of David and Solomon, you get the five wisdom books kind of coming into being. So Job's very old, but But most of them had some significant input around the time of David and Solomon, or attributed to the time of David and Solomon. The Psalms, lots of them are written by David. But Job is this big conversation between him and God, where his everything goes wrong. He's a righteous man, but he loses his home, he loses his health, he loses his kids, he loses his livestock. Everything is stripped away from him. And he's kind of like lying there thinking, what shall I do with my life? How can I recover from this? And you know, you want your wife to kind of give you some good advice, or at least to cuddle. And his wife comes and says, why don't you curse God and die? And he's like, oh, thanks, love, yeah. But in the Hebrew scriptures, time and time again, in the darkest moments, they're the times when the greatest revelation comes. Okay, in the most difficult times are the times when the most wonderful things about God are revealed. And that will be the same in your life. I can promise you, if you'll press into God in the most difficult moments, you'll get the greatest revelations in the times that are most difficult. And Job says this very famous line in chapter 19, verse 25. I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end, he will stand on the earth. I know that my Redeemer lives, and then in the end, he will stand upon the earth. And so around this time, you've got the Psalms, which are the hymn book, if you like, of the Hebrew people. And they've got, it's not like our hymn books often, because a lot of our songs, especially modern charismatic songs, are very cheery and happy. Whereas you'll get stuff in Psalms, if you're really angry and you want to kind of come to God, you think, I'm going to have to cheer up first. You know, I'm going to have to sort myself out before I can join in with worship. But in the Psalms, you can find one that kind of says, I wish you'd like take my enemies and smash their kids against the rocks. Or, you know, there's just this horrific stuff that people say in the Psalms. And they just pour out all of their anger and they pour out all of their bitterness and all of their rage. Or they're jealous about something. And all these different emotions that are found in the Psalms. And we can bring it all to God, because he's big enough to cope with that, okay? And the Psalms give us expression in worship to all the kind of feelings that we've got. Then you've got Proverbs, which is attributed to Solomon. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 24, it says that Jesus is the wisdom of God. So when we read Proverbs, which is all about wisdom, think about Jesus and the way that, because there's a bit in chapter 8 that like does this thing, what would wisdom look like if it was a person? And it looks really like Jesus. It's really interesting to read it. And what you need to do with the wisdom books is you need to play them off against each other. It's almost like they talk to each other. You know, Proverbs kind of says, if you obey God and if you do the right thing, then life will be pretty good. And then Job goes, no, that's not true. and then Ecclesiastes kind of says, everything's basically meaningless. You know, I've tried all these things and life's meaningless, maybe without God. And so you hold all of these together, because they all, you know, the Proverbs practical wisdom normally works. But then actually Job tells us a story which is about suffering, and sometimes desperate suffering comes. And we need to know how Job related to that and how God met with him in those moments. So Ecclesiastes is about life being meaningless without God. Song of Songs is about sex. It's a poem, a love poem, very intimate poem. If you're under 18, you're not allowed to read it. And I know that for a fact that some of you will go and read it now after this. And some people say the intimacy within Song of Solomon is about a picture of Jesus' love for his church. But ultimately, it is a song celebrating the gift of sex and physical love between a man and a woman. So that's the wisdom books. We've got 11 minutes with which to do all of the prophets. Are you ready? Let's do this. In the Northern Kingdom, who's from the north? I'm from the Northern Kingdom. You've got the great prophets Elijah and Elisha. But off of this list here, it's only Amos and Hosea who are from the north. So Hosea is told to marry a prostitute and to But when she goes out and does her work, that he's to love her and forgive her to symbolize God's relationship with his people, that they have gone off with other gods, but God welcomes them back. And when you've lived through something for yourself, it gives you a lot more authority and passion when you speak about it. And so that's what Hosea did. Amos carries this kind of the heart of the prophets, where he says this in 5:24, he says, "Take away the noise of your songs, but let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream." You know, you can sing your songs, you can do all your religious bits, but actually, it's ultimately your worship is expressed in how you treat other people. Do you do justly? Do you love mercy? Do you walk humbly with God? And the people of the north fail to basically ignore the word of the prophets. And in 722 BC, Samaria falls to their enemies, and the northern kingdom falls. And then in the southern kingdom, there's a whole bunch of other prophets that emerge. And all the prophets are doing is they're saying to the rulers, you've got to treat people properly. To the people, come back to God. And they also say, there's one coming. God is going to sort this out. So they point to the future. So they talk to the rulers, they talk to the people, and they point to the future. Those are the three things that the prophets do. And Jonah is this bizarre story about this fish that swallows Jonah, and Jonah goes away. And Jesus refers to Jonah, and he says, people say to him, "Can we have a sign?" Like they want Jesus to do a magic trick or something. And Jesus says, "I'll give you a sign, the sign of Jonah." And everyone's like, cool. So you're going to get like swallowed by a fish and stuff. But actually it's about that one of the gospel writers tells us that it was a prophecy about, you know, he spent 3 days in the grave before he rose again. And Jonah spends 3 days in the fish before he spat out. But if you read Jonah, it's really interesting. Read it by and think about the story of Jesus, the prophet who gives his life so that others can live. There's all sorts of parallels between the Jonah story and the Jesus story. So it's an interesting book to study. Micah, 700 years before before Jesus, there's a prophecy for Bethlehem. In Micah 5 verse 2 it says, "Out of you, Bethlehem, will come one who will be the ruler over Israel." Think about that prophecy that Balaam had as well. "One who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." So there's going to be a ruler will emerge from Bethlehem, whose origins are somehow from ancient times, who originates in days of eternity. And so all of the prophets are doing this. They're pointing to something that is to come. Nahum points and he says, "Look, there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news." Someone is coming who is bringing good news or gospel, which is that's the word. And then Habakkuk comes and Habakkuk says, you know, "I've got all these doubts, and I want to bring my complaints to God. But there's a day coming," in chapter 2, verse 15, "when the glory of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea." The knowledge of the glory of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. And Zephaniah as well. Zephaniah speaks to the people and he says, that the Lord is with you. He's mighty to save. He'll take great delight in you. He'll quiet you with his love and rejoice over you with singing. And so we get to this time where the exile happens for the people in 586 BC. And they're invaded. And the major prophets here all rise up around this time, just before, just after, and during the exile. Isaiah, there's a middle bit of Isaiah, 40 to 55. And Isaiah talks about this servant, a suffering servant. And somehow this servant will take our sin upon himself, and by his wounds we're healed. And the word will go out from God, and it won't return without accomplishing the purpose for which it was sent. And so this servant somehow is this innocent figure who will suffer on behalf of us and will bring us peace. And by his wounds we are healed. And Jeremiah kind of follows this up, and he says, Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet because he cries a lot and he prophesies as well. And he talks about a new covenant. So remember the covenant right back in Leviticus. Jeremiah says, there's a new one coming where God is going to write the law, not just on some tablets of stone, but in your mind and on your heart. So somehow God will empower us from within to obey him, to follow him. So we'll want to obey him. Instead of trying to live up to some written law, God will live inside us and his law will be in our hearts and on our minds. And then when Jerusalem falls, Jeremiah writes Lamentations. And he's crying again, and he's sitting and looking at his city, and he writes these five poems, which are the Book of Lamentations. And it's incredibly depressing. But again, in the middle of it, in chapter 3, he says, I remember the bitterness and the gall. So he brings all his bitterness to God. But then he says, but I also remember this. Your mercies are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And the beauty and the poetry that happens in the middle of Lamentations is just another example of the beauty that God can bring in the darkest moments of our lives. Ezekiel, I don't know if you read Ezekiel, but he's completely bonkers. And he sees, it's like he's on drugs or something. He sees all these mad visions and he sees these wheels within a wheels and rivers getting deeper and wind and dry bones becoming an army. And he's like, I can't really describe it. It was like the Lord, but it was more like the glory of the Lord, or maybe like the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And eventually says it was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And in the midst of all of this awesomeness and around the throne room of God, there's a man sitting on a throne. There's a man sitting on a throne. I'm not sure how Ezekiel does that, but he says that God is going to come and he's going to be our good shepherd and he's going to give us a new heart and he's going to forgive us for our sins and he's going to a heart of flesh rather than a heart of stone. And then Daniel prophesies and Daniel says that he sees this picture of a son of man. And this son of man goes into the throne room of God and he's given all authority and sovereign power and all the nations of the earth worship him. So this kind of divine human is worshipped by all the nations of the earth in the presence of God. And so that there, some of the people prophesying during the exile. We've got 3 minutes, which we are going to finish. Don't worry. And then we get to Obadiah. Obadiah is also prophesying during the exile. And he says, the kingdom will be the Lord's. And that eventually God will become king again on earth as he is in heaven. Esther is also based in the exile, in the time of the exile. She's just here, and she's basically about how God is at work behind the scenes, even when we don't see him in kind of with our eyes, or we're not allowed to mention him perhaps because of the exile. But that's all about God working behind the scenes. Then, after 50 years in exile, Cyrus the Great allows the exiles to return, and we get the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah. About rebuilding the city and the temple. And then we get the last prophets. Joel says that there's a day coming when the Spirit will be poured out on all flesh. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. You know, men and women and young and old, whoever it is, God is going to write his law on people's hearts again. And as this people come back to Jerusalem, Haggai, he's right over here, Haggai says that the glory of this new temple will be greater than that of the old temple. And that God will return to the temple, even though there's no record of God returning to the temple, apart from for us as Christians, when Jesus goes into the temple, and it kind of looks quite different to the first time God comes to the temple. Zechariah says, in chapter 9, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey. And then in chapter 12, verse 10, he says, they will look upon me, the one they have pierced. So this is God speaking. Just take a second just to think about this. They will look upon me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him. So who are they mourning for? How have they pierced God, who is spirit? And who are they mourning for? They will look upon me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. And finally, Malachi. And Malachi says in chapter 3, verse 1, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to the temple. The messenger of the covenant who you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. And the people of God, who have got these promises from the time of Abraham onwards, who have followed God and then were in exile and then were freed from exile, but then they have a few hundred years where they're still oppressed. Whichever the empire of the world, you know, that's ruling the world at the time, they also rule Israel. The Persians, the Greeks, the Babylonians, and eventually the Romans. And they're asking these questions, when will we be free? When will God become king on earth as he is in heaven? When will we have this new covenant that's written on our minds and our hearts? God, how long will it be? When will the kingdom be the Lord's again? When will the Spirit be poured out on all flesh? When will God give us a heart of flesh and send a good shepherd to rescue us? When will our Redeemer stand upon the earth? Who will emerge from Bethlehem, whose origins are from days of eternity? When will this end? How long will it be, O Lord? Now, if you want to come back to Cafe Uno at 2:30, I'll give you the answer. Because obviously you don't know what happens. But that was the Old Testament in 45 minutes, and thank you for listening.